In the Old Testament, we are introduced to the idea or the word firstborn. The first time that we start to read about firstborn is, of course, in the first book of the Bible, the book of Genesis. And finding the word firstborn in Genesis is not surprising. When we look at the book of Genesis, we have information about families, parents, kids, and just like today, parents sometimes talk about their firstborn child. If you were to study the subject of the firstborn, you'd find that not only is it used in Genesis, but we also find the word or the idea of firstborn being used in Exodus. When firstborn begins to occur in Exodus, there are some passages that use this word in an additional or an added way, and that's what we want to point out tonight. If you were to start in Exodus chapter 4, I'm going to, in a little bit, read from Exodus chapter 13, but to sort of lay some foundation, back in Exodus chapter 4, verse 22, you find that Moses is addressing Pharaoh, and Pharaoh is given a rather unusual message. According to Exodus 4, verse 22, the Egyptian ruler was told that Israel, the nation that was being held captive, the Bible says Israel, at least in God's eyes, was regarded, it was seen by God as his firstborn. Pharaoh had not treated God's firstborn very well. And for that reason, God said, you're going to pay. And you're going to pay big time. God said, you have not treated, you've not released my firstborn, so here's what's going to happen. I'm going to come after your firstborn. And not only am I going to come after your firstborn, I'm going to come after your firstborn children. I'm going to come after your firstborn animals, at least some of them. And God said, they're going to die. That's what happened, Exodus chapter 4, verse 23. But you know, as you look at that last plague that fell upon Egypt that involved the firstborn, the Hebrew people did not suffer the consequences that the Egyptians did. When you move forward a little bit in the book of Exodus, now it's time, as we look at Exodus chapter 12 and Exodus chapter 13, now it's time for God's people to leave Egyptian bondage. And as it's time for them to depart Egyptian captivity, this idea of firstborn again pops up. And as I said, in just a moment, I'm going to read from Exodus chapter 13, verse 2. The last verse in Exodus chapter 12 says that God delivered his people from Egyptian captivity. And because of this, because God had redeemed his people from Egyptian bondage, God said, Exodus chapter 13, verse 2, I want you to sanctify. I want you to set apart unto me all the firstborn, whatsoever openeth the womb among the children of Israel, both of man and of beast, God said, it is mine. You look out for your firstborn. You find them. And God said, I want them. Your firstborn, they belong to me. Now, this is not the only time in the book of Exodus that we find God claiming that the firstborn belong to him. Later in the book, Exodus chapter 22, verse 29, a similar statement is made. And then, at least once more, Exodus chapter 34, verses 19 and 20, God again says, the firstborn are mine. Now, why would God say to his people, the firstborn, when it comes to some animals, and when it comes to your children, and I think here the emphasis is on the sons, not the daughters, why would God say, the firstborn belong to me? Well, there are maybe more reasons than two, but I see at least two reasons. First of all, God had delivered the firstborn in Egypt for the Israelites. You maybe remember the blood on the doorposts and so forth, and God passed over those homes. The Egyptians lost their firstborn, humans likely just the sons, certainly some animals. God had kept the firstborn in Israel alive, so God said they belong to me. I protected them. They belong to me. But there is a second point about the firstborn that is not discussed. We tossed this around at a preacher's meeting about a month ago, and I think this bears careful attention. And there's some great lessons from this second point. And this is what I want to key on this evening. So hopefully I'll explain it in a way where you're able to easily follow the thought. When we think about the firstborn, and the second point, there is a concept which exists in our culture and a concept which goes back for a long, long time as far as other cultures. The firstborn in ancient times was usually regarded, typically seen as the center of the family. A firstborn son was someone, and we probably know this from the Old Testament, who had some special responsibilities. The firstborn son was someone who had some special privileges and certainly a greater inheritance. And when you begin to go back and you start looking at the firstborn, especially the firstborn son, you find that firstborn son was able to stand for, or that firstborn son was able to represent all the other family members. We do a similar thing today. Is it not possible for a team captain to stand for his team? The team captain is able to represent the entire team? Sure, that happens at various times. We understand, or maybe it's the head of a company, the CEO, or maybe it is the plant manager. He, or perhaps she, stands for that entire organization. Well, in ancient times, this was often what was true. When it came to a son, that son was able to stand for or represent the entire family. Now, if that's true, and it was, let's see if we can put a couple pieces together that will give us a new perspective about the firstborn and lay the foundation for the main point that I want to deliver tonight. The firstborn, and again, I think the firstborn son is meant, was to be dedicated to God, Exodus 13, verse 2. That's clear. But what did we just say a moment ago about the firstborn son? That firstborn son was also able to stand for or represent the entire family. Let's put the two pieces together. If that firstborn son was designed to be sanctified, set apart to God, and he represented the entire family, that was a way of saying, your son needs to be sanctified to me. But God said, that's also true of the entire family. Yes, I want the firstborn son set apart, but by setting him apart, I'm also laying claim to the entire family. So when we see the idea of a firstborn son being set apart, sanctified to God, there is also, it seems to me, inherent in this idea, the conclusion that the family also belonged to God. And we can take this a step further before we get to the main part of our lesson. As we think about this word first, we not only have firstborn, but you may remember from the Old Testament that you also have the word fruit. In the Old Testament, we read about the first fruits. These were offerings the Hebrew people brought to God. First fruit sounds a lot like firstborn. Born, of course, being applied to human beings. Fruit, of course, being applied to produce. One of the places we'll read about the first fruits is a little later in Exodus. This is in Exodus chapter 23. I'm going to read the first part of verse 16 and then move down a little bit and read the first part of verse 19. I call it A, 16A and 19A. The first part of Exodus 23, verse 16 says, "And the feast of the harvest, the first fruits of thy labors," there it is, "which God said thou sowest in the field," there's to be an ingathering. But he recognized the first fruits. And then down there in verse 19, he said, "The first of thy first fruits of the ground thou shalt bring into the house of Jehovah thy God." When we use that word first, it can be used in a lot of different ways. But one way that we sometimes use the word first is to say that we expect something else will follow. For example, we're not quite here yet. But if we were to say that today is the first warm day of the year, you probably think we were crazy because it's probably below zero out there with a wind chill right now. But if we were able to truthfully say that today is the first day of this year, we would be saying, we would be affirming that we expect more days to come. The first is here, but we would expect that there will be a second and a third and so forth. When God said this is the first fruit, that was a way of saying that more was designed to follow. Additional crops would be produced, and that, of course, would be used for the people. But you have here this principle with first fruits that's also back there with firstborn. God said, "Sanctify me, the firstborn." The firstborn represents or includes them all. And just as the first fruits were dedicated to God, ultimately God was saying, with these first fruits, you're also recognizing the fact that all the fruits belong to me. Yes, the first ones belong, but it's also, just like with the son, it's also the case that all the additional produce belongs to me as well. Now, I give you those two examples to lay a foundation for what we want to talk about tonight. When we look at the scriptures, a basic understanding of firstborn and first fruits helps us begin to realize a very important principle. And that is, when it comes to the world that we live in, every single thing belongs to God. There is not a single thing that we may truly say is ours. There is not a single thing in life which we may say, this belongs to me or this belongs to us. The Hebrew people were taught that when it came to the idea of the firstborn and the firstfruits. But they were also taught this in some other ways. Here are a couple quick references. Deuteronomy chapter 10, verse 14. That verse says, "Behold, unto Jehovah thy God belongs how much?" Deuteronomy 10, verse 14 says, "Heaven belongs to God. The heaven of the heavens belongs to God. The earth." And then Deuteronomy 10:14 says, "All that is therein." There's not one thing, the writer said, that you can look at, look to, that doesn't belong to God. The psalmist, Psalm 24, verse 1, stated it slightly differently. He said, "The earth is Jehovah's, and the fullness thereof, the world, and and they that dwell therein. And then in the New Testament reference, 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 26, Paul said, "For the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof." When we start looking at the Bible, Old and New Testaments, we begin to find multiple verses that say everything, every single thing belongs to God. Now, the passages that have been given should be sufficient. But God, in talking about the fact that he owns all things, seems to have gone almost to the extreme to make this point very, very clear. God has not only claimed that he owns all things, God has taken the additional step to tell us very clearly that we, from our perspective, we do not own a single thing. It's almost, when we look at the Bible, as if God has gone overboard to say, "I am the one who owns it all. You don't have anything. You simply possess, or you're able to use some things, you're able to borrow some things. And what you believe that you possess is just temporary as far as what you're able to do in life." Paul spoke of this in the book of 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 7. He said, "We brought how much into the world, Paul?" He said, "We brought nothing into the world. Not one thing did we bring into the world." And then he said, "For neither can we carry anything out." I'm persuaded that there are a lot of people who do not believe that principle. At times over the years, I've talked with different funeral directors. And it's interested me over the years as they've told me about some of the stories where loved ones have come and they've tried to put something, or maybe were successful as far as placing an item in a casket with a loved one, and then the loved one was buried with that item. Some peculiar items have been buried with people over the years. One of the most peculiar ones I've ever heard about was a watermelon. There was a lady who died, and she loved watermelon. And the family members decided that because her love for watermelon was that great, they were going to get a watermelon. And they were going to put that in their casket, and she was going to be buried with it. Now, I've not seen this one, but I've been told that there was another fellow, he loved to smoke. I mean, that was his thing in life. So when it was time to bury him, they got a packet of cigarettes, a nice packet and pretty packet, and put that in his suit pocket, and he was buried with cigarettes. Nothing wrong in burying someone with something that was an item that they appreciated. People have been buried with Bibles. People who enjoyed potlucks have been buried with a fork and some other things. So nothing wrong with that kind of activity. But as you see people who are buried, sometimes I'm left with the impression that family members somehow have some belief that if they bury something with the loved one, that that item is somehow going to be with them. Or the loved one is somehow, on some level, even though it really doesn't make much sense, it's going to be used by them somehow. But the Bible says no one ever gets to take a single thing with them into the next life. James chapter 2, verse 26 gives us a pretty precise definition about death. James said death occurs when the body and the spirit separate. When that occurs, when that happens, the continuing part of man is no longer here. It leaves the body. By the time we have a funeral for someone, the essence of that person is long gone. It's headed off into the next world. And whatever a person does as far as putting something with the body, whatever a person does as far as putting something on a body, whatever a person does when it comes to putting something beside a body in a casket, that's for the living. It's not for the dead. That's for us, not the person who has died. When a person leaves this life, they cannot take a single thing with them other than the record that they created as they lived on this earth. Now, that is not going to be too comforting for a lot of people, but that is the absolute truth. God wants people to know this, and he's been making this point for a long, long time. There's a passage I think most of us know, but still, because of what we're looking at tonight, I'm going to go back and reread it. This comes from the book of Job, the first chapter. Just a minute or two from now, we'll be looking at Job 1, verse 21. It's here that we have, as far as an Old Testament perspective, some information on possessions. Job was a rich man. But as Job thought about his possessions, he recognized a very important fact. He recognized that he came into this world with nothing. And Job also recognized that when it came time for him to leave this world, he would leave this world with nothing. Job 1, verse 21. He said, and this is after he suffered some losses, "Naked came I out of my mother's womb." I didn't come out with a single thing. I entered this world with nothing. And Job said, "Naked shall I return thither. Jehovah gave, Jehovah hath taken away. Blessed be the name of Jehovah," or the Lord. You see, Job was someone, even though he was apparently a person who lived very early in the history of the world, he was someone who recognized that the whole world is in the Lord's hands. Yet in our time, many think that they are the ones in control. They're the ones who own various things. Some come along and they think, well, I'm in charge of this country. Others come along and they think, I'm the owner of this business. I run this school. I run this prison. This is my organization. When I go home and I look at the items that are before me in my house or my apartment, these are mine. These are my shoes. This is my phone. This is my clothing. This is our retirement account. Whatever we can point to, whatever we have on our person tonight, from the clothing to the electronic accessories, not one belongs to us. Oh, we may have been paid some money along the way. We may have done some work and received some cash, and with that cash or with those funds, we made a purchase. And we may own it from that perspective. But really, God's perspective, what the Bible wants us to know is that we're simply borrowing items for a short time. In our earlier lesson, and now I'm going to flip over from the book of Job to the book of Matthew chapter 4. We used this passage earlier this morning in talking about it is written. Tonight we want to go back there. There's another item or two that we, as we looked at Matthew chapter 4 in the past, may not have noticed or may not have studied in much detail. In just a minute, we're going to pull from Matthew chapter 4, verses 8 and 9. This is the temptation where Satan offered the Lord the kingdoms of the world. And if you found that, and I think many have, let's start with verse 8 of Matthew chapter 4 and read down through verse 9. Here the text says, again the devil taketh him unto an exceeding high mountain, and showeth him all the kingdoms of the world, and the glory of them. And he, that would be the devil, said unto him, that would be Christ, all these things will I give thee, if thou wilt fall down and worship me. Satan, Matthew tells us, offer Jesus the kingdoms of the world. And as you look at the devil's offer, the word all in my mind really stands out. Satan didn't come along and say, well, here's a kingdom, there's a kingdom, I'll give you one or two. Satan takes Jesus and he says, here are all the kingdoms of the world, lays them out somehow. And the devil says to the Lord, you can have all, each one of these kingdoms. And notice, if you will, the word kingdoms is plural. There was glory associated with these kingdoms as Satan laid them out for the Lord. Imagine, if we can, not just all the kingdoms of the world, but let's just think about one. Think about the devil offering us or offering Jesus America. The devil says, here are the keys to the White House, and they work. Here's a deed to all the states, and it's good. Here's the paperwork so that you'll be head over all the bodies of water, all the force, all the parks. I'm going to give you headship over all the armies, all the military branches that you have. And then the devil, after he goes through the list, says, I even want to give you the keys to Fort Knox. It's all yours. All you have to do is worship me. Verse 9, which was also read, is where Satan said, I will give you. And I find these words very, very interesting. You see, Satan, as you look at what he did as far as tempting Jesus, he knows that the idea of owning things is attractive to us. We like to think that we own things. We like to think that we possess things. We like to look at items and say, I've accumulated this, I've earned this, I deserve this, I was awarded this. But that's not the way it is. The idea that we own something is a devil's lie. The devil is eager for us to believe that we own something, and maybe what we are allowed to borrow is truly ours, and maybe we have much. When we pay off that car, and some of us have had that experience, bought a car, paid on it for maybe 2 years, or maybe it was a lease, or maybe 4 years, 6 years, maybe longer. And when we made that final payment, we thought, now it's mine. Ever have that experience? Or if you have had a mortgage on a house, paid on it for a long time, maybe the day came when you made that last mortgage payment, and now you squealed, it is ours. We've paid on this for 30 years, and now it is ours. No more money to the bank. Or maybe you are someone who likes to do some Christmas shopping and there was a Black Friday event. You went out, you braved the cold, you fought the crowds, and there was one more item that was for sale and you grabbed it. And you walked away thinking, it's mine. I got it. I was the last successful shopper for this product. Before we get too excited when it comes to possessions, there's a really helpful verse in the Old Testament. Going back to the book of Psalms, Psalm 39 verse 6, that I think is one that every Christian should be reminded of on a regular basis. This passage, in my mind, describes America, modern America, very, very well, because the writer talks about not only riches, but he talks about heaping up riches. In fact, as you look at this verse and you think about the writer, you could almost picture him, because of what's said, living most of his life in America. When we look around at our culture, we find that a good portion of life involves little more than heaping up riches. As Americans, we're constantly encouraged, whether we do it or not, but we are encouraged to seek the latest and the greatest. And if we get the latest and greatest, then we're encouraged to think about 6 months from now when something new is going to come and how much better it's going to be and how much more desirable it's going to be half a year from now. Here's what an inspired writer said when it comes to accumulating wealth. Surely every man walketh in a vain show. Surely they are disquieted in vain. And then here's the key part, the end of the verse. He heaps up riches and knows not who shall gather them. It is possible for us to amass wealth, to accumulate possessions which belong to God. And maybe we amass so much that eventually we're paying for storage space to keep them all. But God says, know this, you don't own them. You're borrowing them. And God says a time is going to come, maybe sooner than we expect, when someone else will acquire, they'll take over what we have been allowed to use. Of all that we are allowed to borrow, God says, you don't know how the people who follow you will react with what you're able to use in life. For all we know, and if we're old enough to have seen this happen a few times, we probably witnessed this more than a couple of occasions. Maybe after we die, someone brings in a big trash bin. And they, as they look at the items that we were able to use over a period of 20, 30, 40, 50 years, a lifetime, they think, boy, he or she or they had a bunch of junk. And let's just bring in the dumpster and let's just start trashing stuff. That happens. It happens a lot. Or if that doesn't happen, they may say, well, I know he or she prized this. It was important to them. We have no use for it. Let's just throw it away. What we borrow from God for our life, it may be given away. It might be sold. It might be lost. It might be damaged. But there are, in our world, people in abundance who believe that life is the accumulation of possessions. I'd like to suggest tonight that that is the shallowest kind of life that someone can pursue. Because we do not own a single thing. Everything that we have, quote unquote, is really on loan from God. Every single thing. God tells us, God says to us, see life in terms of my owning all things. Because that's the way it is. Not only things, but also people. God says, all souls are mine. Firstborn, God said, yes, I want the firstborn, Exodus 13, verse 2. But that, because the firstborn stood for all, God was also saying, I own everybody else. First fruits, God says, they belong to me. But that also needs to remind you that all the other fruits that follow, they're also mine. I'm letting you have them. I'm letting you use them. I'm not going to be a cheapskate. There are many items that you can possess as far as borrow from me in life. And they can make life a lot easier. But at the end of the day, each one of us is a borrower from God. And that means the question for us is, what kind of borrower are we going to be? We borrow time from God, so to speak. We borrow possessions, every single thing. And God one day is going to require us to account for our stewardship. Were we faithful or were we not? Simple question. But an important question, and a question which is going to have bearing on eternity. Tonight, how do we look at what we're allowed to use? In the right way, the wrong way. If we're not a Christian, we're probably looking at things in the wrong way. And the time to change, that is now. I think most here know the plan to become a Christian. Faith, repentance, confession, baptism. And then we talk about faithful living. Part of that faithful living is viewing and using what we're allowed to possess in life in the right way. Let's make sure that that's what we do as we begin a new year. If we can help you in that way or some other, will you let us know as we stand and sing the selected song?